This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Climate researchers at UW-Platteville spent the last 3 years gathering and analyzing core samples from more than 400 old oak trees in southwestern Wisconsin. Since weather records only date back to the early 1900s, the researchers are hoping the study will paint a more accurate picture of weather patterns over the last three centuries. WPR's John Davis spoke with UW-Platteville Associate Geography Professor Dr. Evan Larson about the Driftless Oaks project.
The focus of this project was to get a better understanding of really long-term changes in how much moisture we have available to us here in the Driftless area in southwest Wisconsin. And we have access to instrumental records, weather stations and people with rain gauges and thermometers, and that type of information in a lot of places can go back into the early 1900s, sometimes beyond that. And that gives us a pretty good idea of what's been going on in a lot of places for about a century. The challenge is that when you look at how climate changes, and I mean climate in all senses of the word, there are patterns and shifts that are taking place on much longer timescales than 100 years. And so, the way that we forecast the likelihood of a flood or a drought is based off of a statistical distribution of the conditions that we've observed. And the challenge is that if we actually haven't observed the full range of conditions in rain, in temperature, then those predictions that we have actually are incapable of actually predicting what conditions we might see in the future. And so one way that you can improve your understanding of kind of what has been and therefore what may be in terms of climate is through reconstructions of different aspects of the climate system from what are called environmental proxies. This can include a lot of different things. You can look at how corals have grown. You can look at the pollen and charcoal and things like that that are preserved in lake sediments for thousands of years. You can look at ice core data and look at the composition of air trapped in ice bubbles and the isotopic weight of water that's been frozen in time and get a picture of what was happening in the climate system over much longer timescales than our instrumental data cover. The proxy that I use are tree rings, and for me, it's a fantastic perspective that you can gain. When you talk to folks in southwest Wisconsin, and you start talking about trees, there are a lot of people that really appreciate oak trees. And for a lot of reasons, they can live a long time. They're tough as nails. They grow out on the edge of the prairie, up on some of our bluffs. They get these wonderful, twisted, contorted forms or that beautiful spreading canopy of a pasture oak. They're really iconic in a lot of ways, and a lot of people identify really strongly with oak trees. For what I do, the beauty is that a lot of times oak trees can grow in environments that are pretty harsh for trees. They're pretty dry. They're on the south-facing slopes, near the ridgetops, where the life of a tree is really influenced by how much water it can get in any given year. And the way that translates into information about past climate is you can look at the annual growth rings of these trees and start to infer what kind of conditions that those trees were growing in. And so if you have an oak tree in southwest Wisconsin that puts on a really wide ring, chances are that was a good growing season, which means that there was a lot of moisture available to that tree. In contrast, if you have a really narrow ring, that was a stressful year. And in this region of the world, that means it was a really dry year. And so using that relationship, what we can do is we can look at growth patterns in oak trees, not just at a single site, but if you look at tree growth across the whole region, all of southwest Wisconsin. If there are certain years where every single tree in that region put on a really narrow ring, you can infer something about regional moisture availability during that year. And using that principle, we've developed tree ring chronologies. So from these records of ring width from numerous trees at many sites, and used that to reconstruct how much moisture was available to these trees for growing over the past three centuries. And by providing that context, we can now look at current conditions, look at how the drought of 2012 that hit kind of the parts of the Driftless really hard. We can compare that drought to other droughts in the past, and with that information, we can better understand the historical context of that and how severe it really actually was.
What area did you choose from in southwestern Wisconsin, these Driftless Oaks, as they are known, and why are they significant?
Well, I should go back to the very start of this project, and I started teaching at the University of Wisconsin-Platteville in 2009, and I teach in the Department of Geography here, and my area of expertise is biogeography, so looking at the living environment and understanding why the things that are there, living there, whether it's vegetation or animals, why they're there, and what processes over space and time have led to the environment that we see growing around us. And so I'm always looking at things, and I've been a dendrochronologist for almost 20 years now, using tree rings to reconstruct past environments. I love trees. They're beautiful. They make great heat in the winter. They're really intimately connected with people. And I was on a bike ride, and I was heading out to the Big M, which is a landmark right near here, and I was biking by some farm fields and pasture. There's some cows out there and this really beautiful grove of oak trees. And as I was biking by, one of them had died and fallen over, and I looked over and, you know, there weren't any baby oak trees, and I thought, oh, I wonder when those groves are going to be gone. And then I started realizing, like, those trees look really old. And then that from that seed came this idea that, you know, here we are in southwest Wisconsin, the Driftless area. And if you go back to the original land surveys from the mid-1800s, and you look at the type of vegetation that was growing here, it was this incredible mix of prairie and some closed canopy forest, but a lot of oak savanna. And these are the prairie oaks that Aldo Leopold wrote about in Sand County Almanac, but these trees that are growing right at the edge of the prairie. You know, there's fires burning by, there's droughts. Life is pretty hard for a tree in those places, and typically the only trees that could really survive for a long time are bur oaks and white oaks. And with that in mind, thinking about here we are in the Driftless area, this area where when you look at the early journals of European explorers moving through the area talking about these flowing prairies and these widely spaced oak trees, and you start to wonder, how many of those oaks are still on the landscape? And moving from that, you know, how do you find these old trees to be able to collect the tree ring samples that then you can use to develop the chronologies and move forward? But it was really the location of the savannas at the time of European settlement that influenced where we focused for this project. And that is the Driftless area. The topography that's highly varied here really led to a mosaic of different vegetation types and provided enough fire breaks that you had forest in some places and you had prairies at others, and then you had that savanna, the mingling of those two community types. And that's really the idea and the concept that gave this project legs, because we'd seen enough, had traveled enough, and had seen enough of these trees and their shapes and their morphology to know that there were some pretty old oak trees out there, and just needed the funding and time to go out and find them. And that's what led to this project.
A lot of these trees are several hundred years old, and I know you had to rely on local landowners and people who were familiar with the area to find them, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was a two-year project. And the first year when we were just starting off, we went and we pulled historical aerial photographs from the map library at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And we'd look over the grounds that are now in our state parks and regional parks in this area and find locations that looked like Oak Savanna, and we would go and scout them, and that worked sometimes. Sometimes we found the trees that we see in the aerial photos. Sometimes they're old, sometimes they weren't. But what we really ran into is that so much of the land in the Driftless area is private. Chances are, I mean, people are good here. We probably could have just gone and knocked on doors. But we also didn't want to intrude on people's privacy. And so we were talking about ways to connect with the people whose land these trees were growing on. And then Sarah Allen and I, Sarah was the, she was a student at UW-Platteville when the project was just starting, and then worked 2 years as a post-baccalaureate fellow, and really did an immense amount of work driving this project, communicating with landowners, coordinating fieldwork, mentoring students. I mean, she was invaluable to the whole process. But she and I wrote a short article to the Wisconsin Natural Resources magazine, figuring that the people who read that magazine are very likely the same people who own property and appreciate the trees on it in a way that, you know, they might notice those oak trees and they might be willing to reach out. And so, you know, after the first year of finding some pretty exciting trees, that second year after the WPR piece and then the Wisconsin Natural Resources article, we were absolutely inundated. It was amazing. In the end, we had over 250 people contact us, inviting us to their property to look at oak trees, to talk about oak trees. They sent pictures, and it was just this amazing sense of welcoming and the appreciation that all of these people shared for oak trees. It was just tremendous. And so that's really when the floodgates opened and we all of a sudden were able to access some of these just spectacular locations throughout the Driftless area. And we found a lot of trees. And yeah, they're centuries old. The oldest living tree was 333 years old. And growing twisted up on a ridge top near Cross Plains, and we found a lot of trees that were just about that age. So they'd seen a lot of time pass by and really provided an amazing window into past climate conditions.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We're talking about the Driftless Oaks Project, which measured centuries of weather patterns in southwestern Wisconsin by tracking data gathered in hundreds of ancient oak trees. We're talking with the study's leader, Dr. Evan Larson, an assistant professor of geography at UW-Platteville. Could you talk a little bit about what was involved in gathering the data, please, Evan?
Sure, I'd love to. This is the part of the project where When everything's said and done and you finally write up a manuscript to publish in the methods, there's going to be this little section. It's going to say that we worked with landowners to identify pre-European settlement oak trees and then collected tree ring data from them. So that's the short of it. The real story is the hundreds of hours out in the field in all kinds of weather, cranking these hand-powered increment bores, which are basically a hollow drill bit, into the side of these gigantic oak trees that have been living for hundreds of years and in the process have twisted in on themselves to make this wood amazingly hard. And on top of that, to avoid concern with oak wilt, we only cored during the cold season, so we cored in snow and sleet and rain. I mean, it was an amazing process. In the end, I think we had 46 different undergraduate students from Platteville participate in the research, And it was set up as these pretty intense field excursions where we'd line up the sampling site. And this is where Sarah did so much work, communicating with landowners, talking about the project, telling them what we're going to do, talking about what it means to core an oak tree, and what that does to a tree, and how really there's no impact on the long-term health of the tree, but just to talk through that whole process. And then once we had the place and the date, we'd gather up as many students as were willing to come with us, and we'd head out and hiking up these bluffs to find the trees. And typically, once we were on a property, if we were out there with landowners, they had so many stories about this place and that place and this tree. And so this wonderful narrative would follow us up, get to the trees. And for those of you who have the listeners who've worked with oak, either through woodworking or anything like that, I mean, it's a very hard wood. And so to take out an increment bore, it's a forestry tool that was designed in the mid-1800s, I believe, by German foresters, and the design is really about the same. It has a handle that's about 20 inches long, and it has a long metal bit, and that bit is hollow, and the space on the inside is about the same width as a pencil. And you place this board, has a sharp cutting end against the tree, and you start turning by hand. And as you turn, there are threads on the tip of the bore, and once it started, it draws that bit in. So as you're turning this bore, that sharp cutting edges cutting out this dowel-sized piece of wood. But the further into the tree you go, the more weight and the more friction is settling in on this bore bit. And it is a tremendous task to turn an increment bore into the middle of a 300-year-old oak tree that might be 5 or 6 feet across and at the base, and where we're coring up closer to chest height, 30 or 40 inches thick still. And sometimes you hit rot and the borer gets stuck, and you spend 40 minutes twisting and pulling to try and get this tool out. Sometimes the tools break. We had broken handles, bent bits, chipped bore tips. In the end, we went through about 26 increment bores in one way or another. And we have those resting on a shelf in the lab as kind of testaments to the challenge of the work. And then if all things go well, once you've cored in, and hit near the center of the tree or as close to it as you can, you put in a thin metal extractor, which pinches that core onto the inside of the increment bore, and you turn it backwards one full turn. And what that does is, following those threads, it breaks that core off from the inside of the tree, and then you draw out your extractor. And on a perfect day, you pull out a perfectly solid piece of wood that goes from the bark all the way to the pith of that tree and tells you the entire life history of that tree growing at that location. Not how it always works, but it happens often enough to keep you going. And then, of course, after you've taken that sample out and we put them in straws and label them so we can take them back to the lab and process them and gather the ringwidth data, the last step is to take the borer out of the tree, which is oftentimes just as hard as putting it in. So a lot of people got quite an intense workout over the process. We certainly let landowners core trees if they were interested. but it was a huge process. Sarah did the lion's share of the field work, and we had numerous students out who put a lot of time and energy toward this. And so it was a great project for that reason, just with so many people involved, from students to staff to faculty to landowners. And that was the process that in the manuscript fits into the sentence that we collected increment core samples from 406 oak trees across the Driftless area.
Did we learn some general things about climate?
Yeah, the story that emerged is really, I think it's a really compelling story. Some of the growth rings on these trees are just tiny. especially the most stressed trees that are growing on the harshest sites that actually oftentimes have the most clear climate signal. And so like the year 1910, trees across the whole region put out just tiny rings. 1895 was another year where the tree ring record was just amazingly fine in terms of the width of those rings. And so you get this surface, and you take them under the microscope, and you go through a process that's called cross-dating. And that's looking at what we call marker rings, so years of particularly interesting growth, whether it's a really wide ring or a really narrow ring, that you see in trees all across the region. And by looking for those signature rings, those marker rings, in all these different samples, you can make sure that you've accounted for each and every growth ring in each and every sample. And so that way, when you combine everything into a single time series of ring widths, you know that you have absolutely accurate data that speaks directly to that year. And so the steps that we took is we developed ring width chronologies for each of the sites that we cored. And we ended up working at 46 different sites where we actually collected tree ring data. And so each of those 46 sites, we went through this process of sanding and cross dating the increment core samples from each of those. And we usually took 2 to 3 cores per tree. So our final chronology had almost 800 ring width series, 800 cores that we analyzed. And you work at the site level, and you cross-date all of these tree ring samples, make sure that everything's accurate, and then you combine them into a tree ring chronology or tree ring width chronology. And you do that by measuring the growth rings using some computer software and high-resolution images to measure the actual width in millimeters of the growth rings. And then you composite those at the site level. And then what we did from there is look at how trees at each of these individual sites were responding to climate. And we compared their growth patterns to temperature and precipitation, and then a measure of drought called Palmer's Drought Severity Index, which is a composite measure that gauges the approximate amount of moisture available to plants growing at a site. And it incorporates both precipitation but also soil moisture availability and temperature to really create a drought index. And so what we found at almost every single one of our sites is that drought index was the most clearly linked climate variable to how these trees were growing. And what we ended up doing was comparing growth patterns all across the region just to make sure that all of these trees had a coherent signal. And what we found was that we really had a very strong regional climate signal. Once we identified that, we could actually go through some pretty interesting statistical processes to draw out the common growth signal that was shared among all of these trees, and then use that information to compare to drought conditions. What we found was that if we looked at that kind of common growth pattern across the entire site, we could explain almost half of the variability in drought conditions, which means visually the time series that we had from ring width matches the time series that we have for drought information really, really well. It misses some of the extreme values, so the wettest years where you have a lot of water that just runs off that wasn't available to trees, and some of the really driest years we underestimate how dry it actually was, just because trees can only grow so slowly before they stop putting on a ring. And from that relationship, we developed a 300-year record of drought variability for the Driftless area, and compared that to both the instrumental climate data to see kind of provide context for the droughts that we have seen, whether it was 2012 or the 50s or the 30s. How do those droughts compare to some of the longer-term patterns of drought in terms of their severity and frequency and time? And the other thing that we did, because there actually is a network of drought reconstructions that were developed by another dendrochronologist named Ed Cook and a lot of his colleagues, and there is information about drought for the Driftless area, but what's interesting is the way that they did that. Actually, there were no local tree ring chronologies available. And so they did the best job they could at estimating conditions here based off of growth patterns elsewhere. And so when we finally put together the Driftless Oaks drought reconstruction, what we found is that by incorporating local tree ring data, we got a much better idea of how drought variability occurred over time here in the Driftless area, which makes perfect sense. So comparing to both the existing reconstructions, which we were able to capture that local signal more completely, and then as well as the instrumental records, if you look at the last 300 years, the late 1900s, from the 1950s on certainly, but 1940s as well, has been one of the wettest periods in the last 300. In the early 1700s, there were comparably wet conditions. But essentially the entire 1800s up through the 1930s was drier than we've seen for the last 50 years or so. And that's long enough of a difference to change our perceptions and our cultural history of dealing with drought. The 2012 drought, it actually, into the long-term context, there are a lot of years that were quite a bit drier than that over the long term. 1895 shows up as the driest year in the past 300 years. The year 1800 was another where it was extremely dry in the Driftless, drier than we've seen in modern times. That has really important implications in terms of projecting kind of single-year droughts and what we can expect to happen with the climate system. In terms of going back to that idea of how we forecast and how we predict the frequency of certain events, once you incorporate how dry it has been over the past couple centuries, relative to what we would predict from just the late 1900s, the potential drought conditions really become a lot deeper and a lot more frequent. Another one of the really poignant pieces of this reconstruction is that in the mid-1800s, there are about three decades of really dry conditions, where almost every single year was below the average that we've experienced over this long-term 300-year record. It wasn't as deep of a drought as other periods, but the continuous drought conditions that kind of reigned over this area during that period would pose really, really dramatic challenges for managing our water resources today. And so from this reconstruction, some of the most important lessons are that for as dry as we've seen it get, there are periods where droughts have been either more intense or more prolonged. And where this information can really serve us is kind of understanding the range of potential conditions that we might face in the future and starting to incorporate that kind of variability into our natural resource and economic plans.
Dr. Evan Larson is an associate geography professor at UW-Platteville and lead researcher on the Driftless Oaks Project. The three-year study analyzed data from more than 400 old oak trees in the southwestern corner of Wisconsin to shed light on long-term weather patterns in the region. He's being interviewed by WPR's John Davis. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation on the Driftless Oaks Project, including what it could mean for the agriculture-rich corner of the state. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. We continue our program on the Driftless Oaks Project, a 3-year study of samples from more than 400 old oak trees spread throughout southwestern Wisconsin. The study is designed to provide insight on the region's weather patterns that goes beyond existing weather records, which are only about a century old. WPR's John Davis asked UW-Platteville's Dr. Evan Larson if the study can shed any light on recent major flooding and the drought year of 2012.
With climate changing as it is, and if you look at kind of the projections of where our climate may be going, there's a group called the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impact. It's conducted by people associated with the University of Wisconsin-Madison, as well as the Department of Natural Resources, as well as a number of other groups. And they've been looking at the likelihood of these extreme events occurring. And the statistical models that they've developed were based off of instrumental data that was available that had good spatial coverage for the state. And a lot of their models are based on 1950s and on, which is just this really small piece of the overall variability in climate that we've experienced. And so with the broader temporal perspective that's provided by proxy-based studies like this, where we use tree rings to expand our understanding of drought variability, what we find is that these extreme events, they happen. The droughts of the past surpass anything that we've seen. And so for as bad as the droughts have seemed, we can expect worse in the future. In terms of the amount of heavy rainfall events, this is really something that's pretty profound. If you look at conditions called pluvial events, where there is above average moisture delivery to an area, we took our reconstruction and we kind of looked at it a couple different ways in terms of looking at if conditions were above average or below average in terms of precipitation, and then also combining that with the number of years consecutively that those conditions persisted. And in terms of pluvial conditions, the late 1900s had two successive runs of some of the wettest conditions that we've seen in the past 300 years, with the only other period matching that in the late 1700s. And so it's kind of an interesting perspective, because while this does indicate that these conditions have occurred in the past, they're really rare. The fact of the matter is that if we look at the three most intense kind of wet periods in the last 300 years, two of them have occurred since the 1950s and only one of them before that. I think what this can do is give us that temporal context for looking at these events. And as we continue to monitor the potential impacts of changing climate conditions, this is really going to help us understand, are we in fact in an unprecedented climate state, or is this within the variability of the system? From this study, we have experienced individual years where it has been as dry or as wet, but in the past, we've been wetter than most of the years in the past 300 years, and these extreme drought events have taken place. Where we're really going from this point forward is to compare these conditions further, because climate varies on such immense timescales that it can be really hard to really know for certain where we're going.
The Driftless region is traditionally been a prairie, but the impact of man has kind of turned it into a agricultural area that's also a prairie as well. How are you hoping this study can inform the approach that farmers and others like weather forecasters or emergency planners take to these events, either floods or extreme droughts in the southwest corner of the state?
Well, I think what's really interesting about crop production in this part of the state is that, you know, we have such rich soils, but at the same time we have such varied topography that, in a lot of places, things like irrigation, they aren't real feasible, which means that our agriculture is linked to the weather and the climate. And when we were looking at how our tree ring records compared to climate conditions around the area, we also wanted to look and see how they related to kind of some of the more, I don't want to say practical, but applied aspects of people's lives and livelihoods in this area. And so we gathered crop production data. We focused on Grant County. That's where UW-Platteville is located. But this data exists for counties kind of throughout the area. And we looked at the production of corn and soy, or the yield per acre. And what was kind of interesting, and this is something that's been observed elsewhere, but as our production techniques and technology have advanced, if you look at the interannual variability in crop production, so not so much the overall trend, which is certainly increasing at almost an exponential pace, but that year-to-year variability, as we fit more and more crop into the same area and gained an increase in yield, the year-to-year changes in those yields is becoming increasingly linked to climate. And it's kind of like we're finally running up against, you know, climate as the real main limiting factor to how much we can grow. And when you think about that, in the context of this study, where we've now provided pretty good evidence that the 1900s, especially during this period where we've had this ramp up in agriculture production, it's been some of the wettest conditions in the past 300 years. What that means is if the relationship between crop yield and climate stays as strong as it is, that we're going to be really hard-pressed to maintain this level of productivity, especially if you look at something like the mid-1800s drought that came out of this work. You know, if our moisture delivery fails for 20 or 30 years, that kind of long-term reduction in productivity could really impact people's livelihoods and the culture of the region. And so I think one of the most important things to come out of this is to understand that the climate that we're living in right now is not going to be the same climate that we're living in 50 years from now. And that to expect kind of the same conditions and the same productivity might really set us up for challenges down the road. And so this is something where to take this understanding of variability and the potential conditions and somehow start incorporating that in how we plan for the future. You know, how much we expect or how much we need to produce to meet our goals in terms of food and economic productivity. With climate potentially changing and swinging to these periods of prolonged wet or dry periods, some sort of buffering system where we can really weather those dry spells in good shape without setting ourselves up for what could be a really really catastrophic economic effect of such a thing. So I think that is the conversation that I hope comes out of this type of work in terms of, you know, the people who are living on and with the land of the Driftless area.
How does the Driftless Oaks Project fit into similar climate change studies that have occurred across Wisconsin, even the nation or the world?
Sure, yeah. Well, and so this is a really interesting region. The idea of scale comes in as being something that's really important because as you look across scales, you see the expression of different phenomena and different weather patterns. And within the tree ring community, there's exceptionally strong evidence that we are entering a time where temperatures are warming to points that they haven't been for millennia, And they're warming at paces that we haven't seen before in the treeing records. And this is across the world regions where you can look at temperature through tree rings. As we start to scale down to the region and the continent, there becomes an increasing amount of variability within that overall trend. The Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts Group projected, especially in the northern parts of Wisconsin, but across the state, decreasing number of really extreme cold events. And what's interesting is that the way that these oak trees grow, they don't really care about how cold it gets in the middle of winter because they're not growing so much. And they might be impacted in certain ways, but it doesn't really show up in the treeing record. And so we don't have a perspective on, say, temperature variability from these trees. There are other predictions for an increase in the number of really extreme events. These 2-inch, 3-inch rainfalls, 9-inch rainfalls. And this is kind of what you were referring to before. And at 37 years old, I don't remember too many spells of, 9 inches of rain over a couple days. And those kind of extreme events, when I was thinking about the reconstruction from the Driftless Oaks, it's really hard to capture that extreme of an event. And so there again, this reconstruction, we might not be able to speak explicitly to these intense 2 or 3 day periods. The seasonal conditions are where we can really finally see that record emerging in this project. And I think the universal issue, and I should say concern, is that as temperatures rise at kind of the global scale, and as increasing amount of energy comes in to drive these extreme events, that even though we might be getting more rain, the amount of moisture that's available to the trees themselves starts to decline because it comes in these huge events. We have these massive floods and tremendous runoff. And what we found with the Driftless Oaks, which I think is really interesting and kind of troubling in some ways, is that if you look at the relationship between drought and oak tree ring width from 1900 up through 2000, the two are matched just amazingly well. They're really tightly connected. When you have a wet year, you have a wide ring, dry year, narrow ring, and it's just beautiful. Starting in about the 2000s, that relationship actually starts to weaken a little bit. And if you start thinking back, really, that's, 1998 was a pretty good drought in a lot of places. But when you start thinking about these incredible flood events and these massive rainstorms, they really started to come into my mind in the 2000s. And it's at that point where all of a sudden we start to lose some of the strength in the relationship between tree rings and climate. And we had a student who took this on, and she started looking at individual growth rings of these trees and what we call weird rings, and that they would be physiologically anomalous. They would look different than all of the different rings. And in the early part of the record, those rings are really tightly linked with droughty and stressful conditions. So when a lot of trees are really stressed, sometimes they put on kind of a ring that looks funny. What she found was that over the 2000s, we've had this incredible increase in the rate of these weird rings. And it's across the study area, and it's in trees of all different ages. And so what we might actually be seeing is the onset of these really extreme conditions starting to stress these trees out in a way that they really haven't experienced in the last 300 years. So even though we don't have perhaps the exact measure of how much rain fell when so much of it runs off, we do have an indication of how stressed these trees are. And over the last decade, they've become really, really stressed.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We're talking about the Driftless Oaks Project, which measured centuries of weather patterns in southwestern Wisconsin by tracking data gathered in hundreds of ancient oak trees. We're talking with the study's leader, Dr. Evan Larson, an assistant professor of geography at UW-Platteville. I know this question does not really relate to the study itself, but this area is part of one of the biggest watersheds in the world, the Mississippi River watershed. Have you thought much about how this study or about how the watershed itself is impacted, or is that a separate study that you have to undertake?
Well, John, that's a great question. And you're right, the Driftless area, water that falls here eventually flows out to the Mississippi and down to the Gulf. And so we are connected hydrologically with one of the largest and most important river systems, arguably, in the world. And so in addition to looking at the drought conditions, in a lot of places and a lot of environments, people have used trees to actually reconstruct how much water is flowing through different rivers at different times of the year and over expansive temporal scales. And so what we're just beginning to do now, taking the success that we had at really improving understanding of drought over the Driftless area, is moving on to start linking this region to a larger area and developing a streamflow reconstruction. And this is where it's an amazing opportunity, and I would really like to put out a call because last time this was so helpful. But in the process of seeking out these oak trees, what we encountered on top of the ridge is, as people are familiar with this region would expect, are also red cedar trees. And, red cedar trees, they invade pastures and meadows. You can often see them up on these incredibly drought-prone rocky outcrops, especially in the bluffs in the Coulee region around La Crosse. Some just incredibly contorted, twisted, gnarly old red cedar trees that could have been there for a long time. And we were at a site outside of Viroqua, it was the last day of the field work for the entire project, and we came across this cedar, and we thought, I wonder. And we collected a tree sample from it, and that tree, which I must say the wood is substantially softer than an oak tree, that tree had rings back to the 1750s. And it was the first tree, and it took about 3 minutes to core it. And so that's when all of a sudden we realized that that's the next opportunity. We've done the Driftless Oaks Project, and we, in other places, when people have combined multiple trees into a reconstruction of climate, a lot of times different trees are capturing different parts of the season, different aspects of the climate, and together, by using multiple species, you can get a much more holistic understanding of how climate has changed and varied over time. And so now we've got this amazing opportunity. The oak chronologies are in place, but if we can complement those with red cedar chronologies, we might be able to vastly improve not only our understanding of drought in the Driftless, but how it connects hydrologically to the upper Mississippi and to the region as a whole. And so that's really where we're looking to go next. We would love it if people were as willing to share the location of cedar trees with us as they were to share the location of these old oak trees, and really see this as the next big step for understanding climate in the Driftless area.
Evan, is there anything else you'd like to add?
It's been a really great opportunity to talk with you, and one of the most important pieces of this whole project and what made it possible was the open arms that people accepted the idea of this project and our work and invited us onto their land and showed us where these trees were growing and made it possible to do any of this. And so, I really want to say thank you to the people who contributed already. And it was an amazing personal experience to interact with so many people who cared so much for their land and their trees. And I want them to know that through their involvement in this project, they've really played a role in increasing our understanding of drought in this region where climate and weather and people are so intimately connected. And so I really want to say thank you to all those people. And I hope that we get to meet a lot more folks like that when we start looking for old cedar trees.
Hey, is this study close to being published anywhere?
Yeah, we're in the process of submitting the manuscript to an international journal. I guess for the sake of review, I won't mention the name of it, but but the data are robust, and we've had it reviewed by a number of really exceptional climatologists, and they're all pretty excited to see it out there. So it should be out in the scientific literature in the next few months.
Dr. Evan Larson is a UW-Platteville Associate Geography Professor and lead researcher on the Driftless Oaks Project. He spoke with WPR's John Davis. The three-year study analyzed data from more than 400 old oak trees in the southwestern corner of Wisconsin to shed more light on long-term weather patterns in the region. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers.